Rabbi Michael Myers, who probably needs no introduction. I started by saying the most important thing to me about Rabbi Michael Myers is I get to call him my friend. And at the same time, he is a scholar. He is a student of history. He is a master educator. He is someone who we know is going to give us something very interesting and thought-provoking and something that's going to leave a very strong impression on us, on his topic about In Search of Utopia, Before a State of Mind. And at no further ado, it's my pleasure to call upon Rabbi Michael Myers.
Thank you. He's also embarrassed. The problem with an overdone introduction is now you got to live up to it. So I will do my best. Thank you very much, Rabbi. I appreciate it very, very much. It is an honor to talk here. It is an honor in any way, shape, or form to be involved with the ongoing growth of Mizrahi and the rejuvenation of our local Mizrahi in particular. And so therefore, it is a special pleasure and an honor to be asked to speak. The topic that I chosen is In Search of Utopia, Before the State, A State of Mind, probably something which seems a little bit arcane to people who have at least seen this title before in the numerous trailers that have come before. So I'd like to first begin by talking a little bit about the selection of the topic. Most countries, most governments are created with the people who are there, either because of some dissatisfaction, some oppression, some revolution, something which takes place on a given tract of land, be it small or large. The state of Israel is the great exception to that. Israel was a state in mind before it actually became a state. And that we, as we're going to see this evening, much of which you, the people who are here, you have spent a lot of time thinking about Israel, working for Israel. And so some of what I have to tell you, I think you're quite well aware of. But the idea is that the state of Israel, the Jewish nation on the land of Israel, in which we govern ourselves, was conceived decades before the state came into being, and it is the product of many great minds that worked toward that noble and wonderful end that to which we are the beneficiaries. Now, nothing happens in a vacuum. And we're going to see tonight, one of the things I want to talk to you about is the fact that the movement to create a sovereign Jewish state on the land of Eretz Israel did not occur in a vacuum. People did not wake up. It's not the product of one mind or one thinker, but it is again in a vacuum. But rather, it is the product of numerous minds, all reacting to events which preceded them. And sometimes I'm asked, when did the modern concept of the state of Israel come into being? I would submit to you, it was July 4th, 1776. Yes? First of all, it's nice to ride on the coattails of it, but I do believe that. On July the 3rd, 1776, the world understood that the people are the servants of the government. By July 5th, 1776, while it was not completely accepted, the concept that the government is the servant of the people became a reality. Even though it was not actualized and finalized until after the Revolutionary War and after the Constitution of the United States. But that concept, based upon Locke and Hobbes and social contract and all of the thinkers that preceded them in the 17th and 18th centuries, that came into actuality on July the 4th, 1776, and the world has never gone back to that. Of course, there are still monarchies. Of course, there is still oppression and persecution. But the concept of democracy, of a state in which the people govern the governors, that in itself has remained firm and fast in Western society. And that was followed up, of course, by the French Revolution and in 1789. And after the French Revolution, there were a whole series of revolutions. Obviously, those didn't happen in a vacuum either. But the idea that people are entitled to rights and that citizens need to have a say in their own destiny, that is, that was a movement with, which had great momentum and continued into Central and Western Europe. And in 1848, which would be, what, 60 years or so after the revolution, the American Revolution, there were a series of revolutions in Europe. And they are, what are the odds of this? They're called the revolutions of 1848. And Jews who lived in Central Europe and who lived in Western Europe, in Prussia, in Germany, of course, those who were in France and in Western Europe in general, Italy, they began to say, we are citizens, if only on paper. Remember, these constitutions that were created as a result of the revolutions of 1848 were by and large pieces of paper. And very often the paper is often not worth the print that's on it. That indeed was the case in many ways. But one thing did not change. The Jews began to look at themselves differently. They began to see themselves as citizens, and they began to feel that they could indeed demand rights of citizens. Now in Eastern Europe, it was quite different. And we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, too. We got a little bit of a late start, so I'll try to condense things. But we see that there were changes that took place in Eastern Europe and the Jewish experience of Eastern Europe. And therefore, the Tzionut of Eastern Europe is different from the Tzionut of Western Europe, where people at least believed that they had rights and that they were full citizens. And of course, part of the consciousness of Jews to Tzionut as an option came precisely because of the despair that they felt and the disillusionment that they felt, because what was on paper in the Constitution was not, in fact, in practice, in the social realm, in the economic realm, in the intellectual and academic realm. So you had the disillusionment of the Jews in Europe, Western Europe and Central Europe, who thought things were going to change greatly. And then you had the Jews of Eastern Europe who knew things weren't going to change. And they had complete deprivation. Obviously, there was some cross current. Obviously, the Jews of Eastern Europe knew to some degree what was going on in Western Europe, and some of the Jews were deeply affected by that. Okay. So this is the background and the setting, shall we say, of what now occurs. I'm going to ask you to turn, if you have your sheets, I will sort of gloss over a number of things in the interest of time, and then of course you can read them yourselves. There is another factor which we have to bear in mind, and that is the Haskalah. The Haskalah, or what is called the Enlightenment, that's literally what it means, is a follow-up. The Haskalah is a follow-up on the Enlightenment of Europe in general, which led to emancipation of Jews throughout, and that of course was followed by the revolutions of 1848. The Haskalah itself is the product of the early 19th century, the late 18th century, the 1700s, the 1800s. Haskalah was a revolution. It was a revolution. And by the way, I want to parenthetically say, all of Zionism, secular Zionism and religious Zionism, all of these are a form of revolution. What is a revolution? A revolution is an aggressive change of the status quo. Sometimes, very often, of course, it takes the form of physical aggression and death. Thank God, in our case, most of the revolution that took, well, most, not all, but most of the revolution that took place with us was an intellectual revolution, again, a state and a state of mind which had to take place. And Jews fought ideas, and many ideas conflicted. But here, the basis of what seems to be the generation of Zionism, shall we say secular Zionism, really the seeds were planted within the Haskalah. Now, and again, the Haskalah is largely because of the liberation movements that were taking place even in the 18th century, the 1700s. Now, the Haskalah actually sought a change in the status quo of Jewish life everywhere. They believed that it was based really on the following principles. Now, I have a sheet here that I've condensed Professor Etkes's Professor Emmanuel Etkes is one of the great historians, particularly of European Jewish history from the 1700s on. He's still teaching at Hebrew University, and he is the author of many works. Not only books, but essays too. And among them, I culled some of the ideas of what Haskalah was, and I mention it to you now because not that Haskalah is as important to this discussion as is Haskalah as setting the foundation of the revolution that we call first political Zionism, followed by religious Zionism. Now, again, I'd like to say in terms of Zionism, we're talking about political Zionism. What do we mean? We mean the active initiation of the Jewish people's return en masse to the land of Israel. Again, oftentimes you hear people say, I'm a Zionist too, people to the right, and again, with all due respect, that they say, I'm a Zionist, and my father was a Zionist, my Zeta was absolutely true. But when we talk about Zionism here, we're not talking about one group of people loving Eretz Israel more than the other. Thank God, all the people who call themselves Zionists love Eretz Israel. The question here is not that. The question is the belief that the Jews indeed should initiate a return en masse, all of us, to create a sovereign state in the land of Israel. There we disagree, even though all of us are Zionists. We're not all necessarily political Zionists. Okay, and political Zionist best is defined by one who believes in that initiation. Now, by the way, that does not mean not waiting for Mashiach, okay, as we will see in just a few moments. All right, so they differed in theology. The Haskalah movement was a rationalist movement. It said that we should cut out as much as possible from our religion anything that had to do with Midrashim, and they don't say cut out the Midrashim, but they say that should not be the focus of Jewish life. That we are a rational religion, and of course that drum was beaten by Moses Mendelssohn, who said that in fact. And he was a religious man. No one should say he was not a religious man. He was an observant man. But what he tried to do was he tried to correlate Judaism with the general Weltanschauung and the general atmosphere of Europe at the time. And what and at that time they even our own great founding. Principles, Jefferson and Franklin and all of them, they were primarily rationalists. They believed, some of them believed in God as an active participant in the world, actively involved in the world. Others did not, but they certainly had a certain reverence for the deity and for God, and they were rationalists. And that's the atmosphere of the 1700s and the 1800s. So the Haskalah were, and of course it brought them into violent, terrible, terrible conflict with Hasidism. Terrible conflict. And sometimes when you have terrible conflicts, after a while, you can't even separate who's right or who's wrong in a given incident, because who initiated and who didn't? Is this just a reaction to the last one? Very sad. That's for a whole course, unfortunately. They also wanted to trim down halakha. All right. Not everybody in the Haskalah was anti-religion, but they all wanted to see changes and reformation of some sort. Not reform necessarily, but reformation with a small r. Torah study and the value of academic knowledge. The Haskalah movement wanted very much to they wanted very much to get away from the idea that Jewish learning is exclusively that which is directly Torah related. And they wanted to get Jews more involved in the general outside world. And to do that, of course, you have to have a general education of some sort, however you define the general education. All right? Whereas, they saw general education as a value in and of itself, as opposed to, let's say, even where they did permit some sort of general education in Jewish life, it was grudging, and it was you do only the minimum that you need, and that's all. Rav Hirsch had a different view. Rav Hirsch, at least according to most people, Rav Hirsch's view was that there is an intrinsic value in general education, and that it should be pursued, but it is, of course, subordinate to Torah education. So he was somewhere in the middle. Then the Hebrew language. Now here, again, you can see now the roots of Zionistic thought beginning to be here. The Haskalah, the Enlightenment, the Haskalah, stressed Ivrit, and stressed especially at that time, by the way, archaeology and other sciences, relatively newer sciences, etymology and the study of words and language development, etc. All of that was coming into play at this period of time. And so there was a great stress on Hebrew. And of course, you can't know Hebrew unless you know Tanakh. So that's why you'll find many, although not all, many Haskalah individuals, leaders of the Haskalah, who knew Tanakh very well. You know, to take it several generations further, Ben-Gurion had a Tanakh class in his house every Friday night.
Right.
Yeah, every Friday night. And it wasn't the art scroll that he was studying. All right, he really took it. And by the way, that's not. I know it sounds like a slap at art scroll. Art scroll is very scholarly in what it does in many things in the Talmud and in the Chumash and the Tanakh. Very scholarly. But on the other hand, it was not like art scroll looks at it. That's for sure. All right, but he did. And to him, of course, this was a great value. Now, as we're going to see. While the Haskalah stressed the understanding of Hebrew, and of course that becomes the foundation, the linguistic foundation of the state, we're going to see Eliezer ben Yehuda took it several steps further. Because the Haskalah really only limited the Hebrew. They took the Hebrew beyond Tanakh, and they used it to create novels, they used it to create serious studies, and they modernized it. But they did not take it to the final step. Ivrit meduberet. Spoken Hebrew on the street. That they didn't have. As a matter of fact, to a large degree, many maskilim felt that, no, you don't do that. It is an academic enterprise. Just like Latin was the language of scholars, Hebrew is the language of scholars. We just don't limit it to Tanakh. Right? Eliezer ben Yehuda's greatness was that he said, that will never work. It needs to be brought to the people. If you will, a certain vulgarization of the language. And of course, therein we have the differences of opinion between, quote, Ivrit kelashon hakodesh, right? Or Ivrit as an academic enterprise, or Ivrit as the davar yom yomi that we speak each and every day in Israel. Okay, so that's what we have. So that's the Haskalah, and of course, relationship to European society. We're going to move in the interest of, you can read that yourself, you don't need me for that. Probably don't need me for anything, but you don't need me for that. You have the next thing I want to talk about is what I call the vital signs of a nation. Now, this is very important for us to understand the underpinnings of all Zionism, and of course, religious Zionism, is that every society, in order to be healthy, needs five areas. One, governance. A nation needs to be able to govern itself. It needs some sort of government. All right. Two, economics. It needs to have a system how people acquire wealth, how people maintain wealth, and how wealth is lost. And what is government? How power is gained, how power is maintained, and how power is lost. Those are two. The third one is security. Okay. Now, security, actually all of these vital signs ask important questions. Who shall be secure? Who does the security? And is this security against an internal enemy, or is it against an external enemy, or both? So these are major questions. You can ask similar questions when it comes to governance and when it comes to economics. But security, I remember I was in Eretz Yisrael, right, literally on the eve of the first Gulf War. I landed there, I turned on the radio, and I'm listening. The Israeli Supreme Court concluded in a court case that even though the Israeli government felt they didn't have enough gas masks for everybody, they could not exclude the Palestinians on the West Bank from getting gas masks, even though the Palestinians then were calling for the missiles. Oh, Saddam, who send the missiles on Tel Aviv. And the Israeli Supreme Court said, if you are controlling them, then you must protect them. Now, whether we like it or we don't, Ashreinu Umatov Chelkin. How wonderful our people is. Again, I don't want to get into the political aspect of it, but that they could look beyond all of that and say, what are the obligations of a Jewish state? That's the difference between us and them. One of the million differences, but that's certainly a major one. And who shall be protected? Who shall do to protect? So that was three, right? Fourth one is what we'll call education and culture. As its name implies, that a nation needs to have an educational system, and that includes certain questions. Who is entitled to educate? Who is entitled to be educated? What shall the curriculum be? This is necessary in any state, whether it's, let's say, a local government, or whether it's the entire United States itself. And of course, we debate that as to whether there should be a federal system of curriculum, federal, etc. All of these things are debated. But here's what's, and then the last one is spirit. How does a nation feel about itself? So therefore, for example, if on September the 10th, 2001, you ask the average American, how secure do you feel in America? The answer would be on a scale of 1 to 5, probably 4. Ask them how they feel on September the 12th, and then it becomes obviously much different. And ask the average, ask the average American in 2005, what's our economic condition? They'll tell you, bingo. All right, the market keeps going up and up and up, but ask them in 2009, without laying the blame on any one person. Really, I'm not, right? Ask them in 2009 how they feel. What would they rate the United States? Then they would say, it depends, of course, some people still have a 2, 3, maybe. How are we ever going to get out of this? How are we ever going to, okay? So how the spirit is actually how we feel about the other four elements. But here's another thing. These are vital signs. Why? They're vital signs because they're all interdependent. You can't have a nation say, listen, the education system is going great, and the governance is going terrific, and security is good, but the only problem is we have no money. All right? Because soon that will impact on all the others. An organism is a body in which all parts are interrelated. So if we have a great economy, but a poor school system, it will eventually affect not only the economy and governance. If we have an oppressive governance or a completely incompetent governance, so no matter how well the other things are going right now, eventually the governance is poor, so it will affect education. Now we have two of the vital signs. And if you have more than that, of course, you have a train wreck of countries. And we know we don't have to look to see there's lots of countries. Particularly in South America, were that way, and other places, not to mention many, many other third world countries. So here, why do I bring this up? And this is the genius of our people. Hashem sent these people to us. Every one of the essays that you can read that were written by Ahad Am, that were written by Ritzvi Hirschkow, they're written by whoever they were written. They all took into account every one of the vital signs. That's what I mean by it's a state of mind. They were all living in Europe. And what do? They're thinking about, shall it be a socialistic state? Shall it be a capitalistic state? What shall it be? And how are we Jews going to protect ourselves? So whether it's Jabotinsky or others, these are all pre-state people, they had to decide. And they had to deal with it. But the interesting thing is, no one of them just said, listen, you know what? I'm only going to worry about security. I'm only going to worry about the politics of it. Every one of them had to be able to contemplate every one of the vital signs, because intuitively they knew you can't have a state that has a wonderful government and nothing else. And you can't have a state which has education and culture and no way to support the education and culture. So that's the genius that Hashem sent to our people. That whether we agree or we don't agree with what they did, the secular Zionists or others, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, these are all tools that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent. They're all, wittingly or unwittingly, these are the shlichim that brought about this magnificent, magnificent entity that we call Medinat Yisrael in one form or another. That doesn't mean you have to agree with the person.
Right.
But you have to recognize one of the things that bothers me, I must tell you, it does bother me to this day, that when, if you talk to, in certain circles, they'll say, oh, yeah, Herzl. Wasn't he the one that wanted to get Uganda? Yes, he was. That if anybody took the time to read what he said, this will be the first step. Right now we have to save Jewish lives. It was after the Kishinev pogrom. And so he said, save Jewish lives. I'd like to know anybody who could quibble with that idea. Now, you could argue you got the wrong solution to save Jewish lives. That's okay. But to say, to reduce his life? Wasn't he the one that wanted Uganda? What a travesty that is. And that's one of the things I always urge people to understand. That Herzl, by the way, might have been the least... He had a tremendous a drive to him. When you think about it, within three years, 1894 was the Dreyfus affair. He was at the Dreyfus trial. He saw the Dreyfus trial. He saw that even in France, which was considered to be the most liberal country, the most accepting country in the world, that the Jews, he was pushed out. He lost his rank. He was sent into exile, and all on Trump charges. Now, he noticed that was in December in 1894. By August 1897, First World Zionist Congress. No emails, right? No jet planes to get him across the world. To this day, I can't figure out how this person, one lonely guy, did all that he did, and he literally mobilized an entire people. Now, some people admittedly said, no, not for me, it's not for us, and it's wrong, but that's what he did. So this is also a shliach of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. All right. Again, Mike, I wouldn't eat in this house. That's true. I wouldn't eat in this house. All right. But I recognize that despite the fact that his doctors told him over and over again, your heart. He literally gave his last breath and last heart's beat to the Jewish people, and for that we owe him respect. Absolutely, my view. All right. Now. Time is relatively short. So we have the Mizrahi Manifesto. That's us. Okay, manifesto I used to think was a meal. But then they told me, no, it's just a statement of policy. And I got over my disappointment, and then I read it. Okay. Now, notice that it's written in 1902. Rabbi Yosher Bar Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, called them the Yosefs of 1902, all right, 56, 62. Why did he call them that? First of all, his name was Yosef, and he didn't sell that short either. He saw himself as Yosef in a way, because remember, just as Yosef fought against all of his brothers, who themselves were great tzaddikim, so he too fought against many of the Gedolei Yisrael when he became a Mizrachius. And so he says, if you ever get a chance to read that, he has an essay called Joseph and His Brothers. You could probably get it through here, or I don't know whether it's online or not, but we can certainly get it, where he writes, he says, Yosef and his brothers had a disagreement about the destiny of the Jewish people. What is the destiny? And so he said, by the way, you could ask the question, why was Yosef right and they wrong? Because we have a rule. We learned it last week. Achrei Rabin Latov. Did you follow the majority? The great majority of Gedolim in the year 1902 when this was written? They said, don't do it. Don't pursue this. But the Mizrahi went against them and said, we have to do this. And notice what they write. And Rabbi Yosher Bar undoubtedly read this manifesto. He was born the year after it, so he obviously was not a part of its writing. But he writes... In the lands of the diaspora, the soul of our people, our holy Torah, can no longer be preserved in its full strength, nor can the commandments, which comprise the entire spiritual life of the people, be kept in their original purity, because the times are besieging us with difficult demands. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's easily read. But we can see here that here is the, and by the way, also read the notes underneath when you get a chance, because these notes are informative, and this one is particularly informative for us as well. That while the rest, much of the Torah world opposed the organized initiation of a movement towards sovereignty in a Jewish state, Mizrahi said, "There ein brira, ein brira." Even though this was a little bit before the Kishinev pogrom, and by the way, the Kishinev pogrom is a watershed event in Zionist history, and that's what motivated Herzl to accept the offer of the British, or at least to propose to accept the offer of the British to give us Uganda. It was roundly denied. It was roundly, you know, denied and turned down. But nevertheless, this everybody realized Kishinev is telling us something. It is I heard last week Rav Naor, but Saul Naor said, he quoted Rav Kook in Rav Kook's statement that there's such a thing as a shofar pasul. What does a shofar do? It sounds a warning. So there's a shofar kasher, that's what we hear on Rosh Hashanah, and then there's the shofar pasul. That would be Hitler yimach shemo. That would be ISIS yimach shemo. They're also sounding an alarm. The question is, do we hear the alarm? Are we willing? Again, irrespective of our particular issue tonight, but that's the idea. Now, you can read the manifesto. I'd like you to take a look now on sheet 3. Looks like this. Again, most of this you can read individually. I do have a little exercise that I want us to see a little later. All right. This is the first of the harbingers of religious Zionism, which, again, comes a bit after the initiation of secular Zionism. But they all come, again, remember, they all come within the context of a world that is rapidly, rapidly changing. So this is Ritzvi Hirsch Kalischer, lest we not realize what he was. Ritzvi Hirsch Kalischer is found on every major Mishnayos, in other words, the Jochen Boaz Mishnayos, he's right there. Who knows how many millions of rabbis wrote on Mishnayos? His is the one that's selected. So we're not talking about small potatoes here. We're talking about a person who was a posek and who was a massive Talmud Chacham and recognized throughout the Torah world. Watch what he reads, what he says. Dear reader, and this is in Drishat Zion, a work which he wrote and has been maintained. Thank God for, you know, you can get it at bookstores, both in Hebrew, and I think there might be English versions as well. My dear reader, cast aside the conventional view that the Mashiach will suddenly sound a blast on the great shofar and cause all the inhabitants of the earth to tremble. This is a revolution, ladies and gentlemen. Can you imagine reading this in 1862? He's not saying Mashiach isn't coming. He's saying your view of how this is going to happen. You're going to wake up one day and there's going to be a shofar kasher right outside your door, and he's going to be on a donkey. And he says, cast that aside. That's a revolution. That's why I say all Zionism involves some form of revolutionary thought. Okay? He says, on the contrary, the redemption will begin by the awakening support of the philanthropists and by gaining consent of the nations to the gathering of some of the scattered of Israel into the Holy Land. Now, it's important to note that this is not a new view. However, it is perhaps the most bold statement, because the Ramban actually alludes to this in a parish of his on Shir HaShirim, in which he says a similar thing. V'shav Hashem Elokecha, God will come, v'shav v'kibetzcha. It says v'shav twice, and that is indicative of there'll be at least two waves of redemption. Yes?
Whoever is the Ramban commenting on in Shir HaShirim?
I don't remember. I don't remember whether. I don't think the Shavuot. And of course, Rabbi List last session made a wonderful presentation of the three Shavuot. I don't think it's on that.
No, it's not.
As a matter of fact, it's on the Pusik in Chumash, but it's in his commentary on Shir HaShirim. Yeah. Why do the people of Italy, now listen, see, here you can see the echoes of the revolutions of 1848 and what's going on in Europe. Why do the people of Italy and of other countries sacrifice their lives for the land of their fathers while we, like men bereft of strength and courage, do nothing? Let us take to heart the examples of the Italians, the Poles, the Hungarians, who laid down their lives and possessions in the struggle for national independence. How we, the children of Israel, who have the most glorious and holiest of lands as our inheritance, are spiritless and silent. So you can see that clearly he is moved by what's going on in the world. It's not just he woke up one morning and said, I think, let's rethink things. He's moved by what's going on. He sees all the movies. He sees the revolutions of 1848. He sees the aftermath of those revolutions. And he realizes, why not us? But of course, throughout Rishatzion, he knows that he is going to have to show support for his views from those very texts and that very Torah, that his readers, they're going to be the ones who are going to be reading him. Herzl's not going to read him. All right? We need to be convinced by that. Yes.
Just real quick, what year was this?
1860 okay. Something.
And where was he writing from?
62, yeah. What?
What country was he in?
He was in Eastern Europe.
Okay.
Yeah.
So wouldn't this be in our basic DNA?
What?
Reestablishing and going back to Eretz.
Yeah, but if in our DNA, there's another aspect to our DNA, and that is we've been sent to our room. Since the time of the Beis HaMikdash, we have been exiled. Go to your room. And when the time is, you can come out. Okay? And that is the tension. That's the give and take. These are all great Jews. The ones that say don't go, don't initiate, and the ones who say do initiate. I teach a course on Zionism, and I started by saying as follows. I used to believe that in Shemayim, the Satmar Rebbe, Zatzal, and the Cook, Zatzal, we're neighbors. I no longer believe that.
What?
No. What? No. I believe they're chavrusas. Why? Because each of them loves the Torah with all its heart. Each of them use the Torah HaKadosha to understand what is going on in the world. And now they're debating it. Whatever that means to debate it. So I do believe exactly what I say. I believe they're chavrusas because that's everything there is l'shem Shemayim. Because they're in Shemayim. So. All right, good. All right, so now I want to just show you. Now, however, there is a strong religious position that opposes the return. Notice the very next text, too. This is Rav Shamshon Froher, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. When the rebellion led, and this is in his parish on Deuteronomy, Parshat Eiket, it's also found in, sometimes you'll get a Rav Hirsch, Birchas HaMazon, or his sitter. He put it there too. He or the editors put it there. When the rebellion led by Bar Kokhba proved to be a fatal error, and the need arose to make Jews keep the warning constantly in mind not to make the attempt again to restore the Jewish state by their own force of arms, but to leave the national future entirely to God's management. Then the sages sitting in council in Yavna wrote a fourth bracha, which we call Hatov HaMeitiv. And so Rav Hirsch was an adamant anti-Zionist. He loved Israel no less than the secular Zionists, more probably in many ways. And certainly, even at this time, Rav Hirsch is writing, probably in the 1870s, he already sees that there is a religious Zionist movement, and he feels that he needs to place his, shall we say, place his hand on the side of not initiating. Okay? Now, just in the interest of time, again, because most of this is here, let's go to the last page. I know that sounds like we're missing a lot. Okay, well, first of all, okay, by the way, just for one moment, Jabotinsky, for example, this is not the last page. What did Jabotinsky do? He dealt with the vital sign of security. He said, you're all forgetting that. And and Jabotinsky said, he was called a revisionist. What does it mean, he's a revisionist? He said, you need to revise the way you look at yourselves. You see yourselves as victims for 2,000 years. Stop it. See yourselves as active participants in your own achievement of your destiny. And you got to do that by force. How's that? Okay? All right? Now that's Jabotinsky, A Noble Life, condensed into two sentences. And he died here in the United States in 1940. Yeah. He was on a tour here. And he sadly just... He died.
Went to his cabin.
Right, yes, here in America. Yeah. Then they moved. And who moved him? Begin.
Begin,
his Talmud. And if you ever go to Begin, by the way, if you ever go to, how many of you have been to Begin's the museum? Okay, well, that's wonderful. It's a great place. I think it's a fantastic place. Yes? And if you get a chance to do it, to go to Begin's museum, and also go to the gift shop there, you will see quite a number of Begin's works. He consistently calls Jabotinsky Rabbeinu, Rabbeinu, Rabbeinu. And it's in Hebrew. There might be some, I'm sure there are works in English there too. But if anybody feels they can read the Hebrew, get the Hebrew. Because Begin's Hebrew is poetic and lyrical. And he writes about his Rebbe in that way. And it's worth it. Okay. Here's what I want to do. I think because we're really short on time. Let's go to the last page. On the Jewish people's right to the land of Israel. Most of the quotes that we've skipped speak for themselves. You can see that, or you can give me a call or email me, that's fine too. I want us to observe here the difference between one of the great secularists, a modern secularist, how he views Zionism, and how Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk Zatzal, how he viewed Zionism, remembering, of course, that Rav Kook died in 1935, all right? 13 years before the state. Okay. Here's what Rav Kook writes. Eretz Yisrael is not something apart from the soul of the Jewish people. It is no mere national possession, serving as a means of unifying our people and buttressing its material or even its spiritual survival. Eretz Yisrael is a part of the very essence of our nationhood. It is bound, here's the key word, organically to its very life and being, meaning our, the nation. What Eretz Yisrael means to the Jew can be felt only through the Spirit of God, which is in our people as a whole, through the spiritual cast of the Jewish soul, which radiates its characteristic influence into every healthy emotion. The key here is, I know it's a lot of talk there, all right, but the key here is that it's like this. I own this book. I'm separate from this book. It's my book. Rav Kook says, this book is not like your land. Your land is not like your book. Your land is more better to be said. This is my arm. It is I. This is my land. It is I. It is not our possession. It is not something that the Jewish people owns. It is a part of our being. Just as surely as my arm. I don't own my arm. It is I. I am literally organically bound to it. So that was Rav Kook when he wrote. I'm not sure exactly when he wrote it, but probably in the 20s. Okay, and I'm sure it did not change much as he aged. Amos Oz. Amos Oz is one of the great writers of the modern Israeli society. Great does not mean I agree with somebody, but there is a great writer is one who provokes thought. Now, let's read this together and see. He wrote this in, I think, 1978 in a book called L'Or HaTchelet V'Halavan. L'Or HaTchelet V'Halavan. It's a series of essays. This one I thought was really good for us to see tonight. And we'll see the stark difference between Rav Kook and Amos Oz the secularist. The land of the Jews could not be born, nor could it exist anywhere but on this spot. Not in Uganda, nor Ararat. Ararat, as you will recall, was a project that some people had proposed to have all the Jews transported to Ararat, which is in northern, in New York, in New York State, nor in Birobidzhan. Birobidzhan was also a province in Russia that people said, let's give the Jews a state there. Okay, and all of those, of course, were rejected. Because it was to this place, namely Eretz Israel, that Jews turned their hearts in every generation. Regarding this, I must make a serious, almost cruel distinction between the internal motivations of the return to Zion and its justification to other people. The yearnings of the generations are motivations, not justification. Political Zionism made a political tool out of religious messianic yearnings. properly so. But our justification as regards the Arab populace of the land cannot rely on our yearnings throughout the generations. What do they care about our yearnings? There is no objective justification for the Zionist enterprise beyond the right of a drowning man to grab the only plank in the sea available to him. That justification is sufficient. So you can see there is a huge difference between them. And secular Zionists, by the way, I'll conclude in a second, but in the early stages of the religious Zionist movement, before Mizrahi was founded, there were two primary views that were in vogue. One is that the Jewish people needs a place to go to. This is not terribly different from Amos Oz, except for the fact that they believe they did it because we believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants it to be. The other view is, of course, which is pretty much our prevailing view, is that the time of the Mashiach, it's either Atchalta de Gula or Reshit Tzmichat Gula Teinu, or it is the time that God wants us to initiate to come to Eretz Israel. That's not necessarily the same as going there because of pogroms. Okay? Now, so Amos Oz says, look, that's it. We need a place of refuge. This is it. No other place makes sense. This is it. And Rav Kook said, no, it's not that. Eretz Yisrael is organically a part of us. We'll conclude with one last statement by Rav Kook. Of course, everybody quotes Rav Kook, but you can see that I have quite a number of other people. Some of them are pretty stunning portrayals. Let's see if I can get the last thing on Rav Kook, because it 12?
Yeah.
Okay, good, yes, 12. The reason I put this last is actually because I did want to end pretty much with this. Rav Kook's idea of Eretz Israel was of Medinat Israel was probably the most complete conception of all religious Zionists. Meaning to say, even now, again, all those people, whether they call themselves political Zionists or Mizrahi Zionists, they all pretty much say the same thing. Eretz Israel, Am Yisrael, etc., and it's ours. Okay. Rav Kook said, yeah, maybe ours, but we cannot just say it's ours and that's it. There are five vital signs, right? There's the economics, there's security, and there's the political, and there's the education and culture, and then there's the spirit of Am Yisrael. Rav Kook had the most developed philosophical explanation and shall we say blueprint of a Jewish state of all the Gedolim that I have ever read. And this is just a capsule of it. This is in Orot, at the very beginning of Orot. We must arouse the renaissance of Israel with all the faculties concentrated in the nation, with all her Torah, with all her faith, with all her character, with all her goodness, with all her wealth, with all her power, with all her enlightenment, with all her song. That's, by the way, an appeal to art. Right? With all her strength, with all the passion of her existence, with all her energy and capacity for success. Each and every light within her must extract from the inner treasure of the life-giving light. The spiritual sense sees the torch of Israel rise. From Eretz Israel, everything bursts heavenward. This is how Rav Kook saw a Jewish state. And he saw it in its completeness as much as one could, even to physical education, art, science, literature. He wanted a whole culture of literature. You don't find that among the writers, especially those who are not the Zionist writers. He, of course, was only Rav Kook. Okay, thank you very much.
You may have some time for the mic.
Yes, oh yeah, sure.
Do you have any questions?
Sure. Yeah. Class, questions? Yeah.
So we're for all Gersh. This stresses me. If you read his writings, he talks about Orla Dayan, this great view of Klal Yisrael.
Mm-hmm.
What are purposes in the nations of the world? He writes a lot about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it just what he said just upsets me.
Which, this last thing that you read?
No, not Rav Kook, I meant Rav Shamsham Fowler.
Yeah, I'm saying this last thing that I read for you, the one small selection that I took. Remember, whenever you take a snippet of somebody's writings, it's not very fair. But I think, yeah.
Did he realize what was going to happen in Europe?
Well, first of all, he had no doubt. No, actually, Rav Hirsch was a great admirer of German culture. There's a famous speech that he made in which at a graduation of the school system that he had, high school graduates, in which he praised Schiller, the great German poet, as to, you know, so Rav Hirsch also an extraordinarily fertile mind. No one could predict Germany of 1940.
Did he read Moses Hess? Did he see what Moses Hess?
Yeah. But
didn't he see Moses Hess's view that Jews cannot survive in Germany?
I would imagine he agreed. Yeah, he lived in Germany, so he had a different view, right?
He had a different view of what would it
be. Of what would be. He a different
Moses
view.
Moses Hess laid it out clearly in 1962. He said,
yeah, to Moses Hess's satisfaction, not necessarily to reverse.
Made a mistake.
Yeah, that's right. To reverse. Yeah. Neither. What? Yeah. Yes. I'm sorry. Yeah. Quick. Yes.
You know, number 11 was Rabbi Yosef Dov's salivation.
Yes.
I'm trying to understand, this is the law, his, you know, basically the last line, the historical law will be of Joseph 5, 6, 6, 2, 2.
Yeah.
That's what he's saying, that Mashiach was to come?
No, well, I don't know whether that's the focus of that. I'm sure he believed also that Mashiach was on the way, so to speak. I don't want to paraphrase his songs, but what he meant by that is as follows. Yosef, in other words, of course, when it comes to halacha, the majority rules. The majority of chachamim rule. And he, of course, agrees to that. But when it comes to the historical imperative, when it comes to the destiny of the Jewish people, here's what he said. The destiny belongs to the dreamers. That Yosef was a dreamer. And that the Yosef of 56, 62 were dreamers. And the halacha, or shall we say the halacha of history, goes with the dreamers. That's the whole purpose of the story of Yosef as he lays it out. There's an entire essay, and that's all in English. So, you know, it's one that you can see he builds it. And so that's what he means by that here. The historical destiny is with the Josephs of the world, whereas the halachic destiny, kasher, treif, usser, mutter, those things go with the... by the way, one is no less important than the other. Yeah.
You mentioned Eliezer ben Yehuda.
Yes.
I visited Beit HaRav Kook a few months ago.
Yes.
Something I highly recommend.
Yes.
And I don't remember exactly what happened, but there's some mention of an encounter with Eliezer ben Yehuda and Rav Kook, which turned out to be the last day of Eliezer ben Yehuda's life.
Mm.
And in it, Rav Kook did mention him returning to Torah and...
That Eliezer ben Yehuda was?
Yes.
I hope that's true.
Rav Kook mentioned, I think
that Eliezer ben Yehuda was returning to Torah?
No, he wanted him.
Oh, he wanted him. Yeah. Can I just tell you a quick story about Eliezer ben Yehuda? This is what it takes to found the Jewish state. Now, first of all, I think it's safe to say he was a Meshuggah. Because anybody who is that driven, Herzl was a Meshuggah. You have to be Meshuggah. And I say that with reverence. I don't mean that as a joke. You have to be. So here's a story, one of my favorite stories of Eliezer ben Yehuda. Toward the end of his life, he's too sick to go out of the house, and there was some sort of a debate going on in his neighborhood, which is, by the way, he lived in the Ethiopian neighborhood of, if those of you who know a little bit about Ethiopia, is an Ethiopian street, small Ethiopian neighborhood. And he lived there, and he sent his secretary, a man by the name of Pinchas Ne'eman, to give his view of what should be at this conference that they were having. And it was apparently a matter of great importance to Eliezer ben Yehuda, and it was a matter of great importance to the other people. So Ne'eman goes there. He spends 2.5 hours there, and he comes back. And he says to Eliezer ben Yehuda, says, "Nu, ma kara?" So he said, "You lost." All right. So he said, "Really?" And Ne'eman, his secretary, is really forlorn. He says, "Oh, you lost. I feel terrible. They didn't listen to you." So Eliezer ben Yehuda, I'll say this in Hebrew and then I'll go into English. He said, Eliezer ben Yehuda said to him, "Haim kol ha'vikuach haya be'ivrit?" He said, "Ken, bevatai." He said, "Nitzachti." was the whole thing conducted in Hebrew? And he said, yeah, it was. You lost. He said, "Good, I won." And that's what it takes. See, that's what it takes to be. You need Eliezer ben Yehuda to look at a world like that. Okay. All right.
Yeah, thank you.